Welcome back. Happy Sunday, everyone. John Lopez with Captain Scott Null, Captain Dean Thomas, and Captain Caleb McCumber. Right into it. Scott, you're in the back drains and passes a lot. Your thoughts on how to handle getting in and out of, you know, when folks are fishing there?
Yeah, you can't block off hundreds and or thousands of acres of water and keep it all to yourself because you want to fish a drain that leads to all that. You know, if it's the only way in and out, you're going to have problems. If there's, you know, I know the water just as well as, you know, Caleb's talking about. I know other ways to come into different places. If that's available to me, yeah, I'll cut off of that one. I'll go to one of these others. But like here this week, the tide was out so low, a lot of those other places were not available to you. And I watched it happen over there going into Conteeti. There was two boats had pulled up and they were waiting on either side of the cut going into Conteeti, and boats kept coming by them running back there. Well, it was maybe 8 or 10 inches that they had to get over.
Yeah.
In order to get into that lake. And there was no way people were going to slow down. You couldn't. I mean, there's just no way. And they didn't have there was no other way around it. You know, the other entrances were dry. That's the deepest entrance. Mm-hmm. And just so happened to be right where these guys decided to wade fish, because I guess they didn't want to go all the way back in there on the low tide, but they were waving their arms and mad, and both of them, hey. You know, one pair ended up getting back in their boat and moving. You know, it's playing football on the freeway. You know, you can't really expect people to screw their boat up or get stuck, you know, to avoid you if you're going to block off a lot of water.
Oh man, that drives me wild when people when they're waiting that runway. It doesn't happen much in Matagorda, but man, in Galveston, and you know, God dang it, I feel like I'm giving tournament fishermen a bad name, but at the end of the day, we're trying to make a living, and there's a couple of really good fisheries over there, and people will scatter out and fish the mouth of it going into those lakes, and it's just cutting it off. And typically, I just when they're wade fishing and casting across it, I just find something else to do. But Scott raises a good point. You know, I'm not trying to sound, none of us are trying to sound like we're just jerks that are going to prove a point that if you're there, we're going to run past you. We're in Louisiana last week, and I was there for the Professional Redfish League. And then the Power Pole Championship was the 2 days after we left. There was probably 150, 160 boats on the water. And most all day long, I'm running and I'm running through my little fingers and ponds, getting to where I'm trying to go. And then there'd be a boat in one of those ponds or in one of those fingers. And I'd turn around, and it cost me 5 or 10 miles to go way around them and find a different way to go around them. So we will avoid you if we can.
Yeah,
it's not like, oh, I'm going to show you for trying to fish in this ditch right here. But if we can't, you got to go. You know, if I've got a boat full of paying people that are paying me to go chase those redfish that are back there, I'm going. It's going to happen. Just, you know, accept it. That's how it is.
You know, so the answer as far as from where we're sitting is, you know, you didn't miss a memo. Sometimes going by you is the only etiquette that's available. You know, I'm not saying that you shouldn't slow down. I do when I can, just like you guys were talking about. But sometimes you should be, you're better off if the guy just goes right by you or the girl just goes right by you. All right. So July 4th weekend is coming up. But one thing about the 4th of July weekend or any holiday weekend is a lot of people go out there that don't run their boats very often, maybe 5, 6, 7 times a year and a lot of holidays. So I was talking to JT Koshy from the Boatyard about this, on how to mitigate that a little bit, you know, how to reduce the odds of something going wrong or something having been bad from sitting. So this is really good stuff from JT Koshy at the Boatyard. JT, I was talking with you. You said you guys were like pretty much overrun with people who hadn't run their boats in a long time, hadn't been on the water in a long time, looking for some service before Memorial Day. Some people get out without getting that service done or unknowingly had an issue with their motor or their boat. And sure enough, they see you on the Tuesday after Memorial Day because something bad happened on the water. I wanted to ask you about that, you and I and Caleb and Scott And a lot of our listeners, we're running our boats all the time. And it's the old adage, you know, you got to run your boat. You got to run it and it stays healthy and happy. But frankly, that's not the real world. You know, a lot of our listeners, a lot of people that you see, they maybe run it only on the holidays and three or four other times all year at the most. And that's fine. But those people need to do certain things. You know, when you're not running your boat a lot, you know, very often, what do you tell those folks to maybe, you know, mitigate the number of problems they have on the water? Because everybody knows there's nothing worse than being stuck out on the water.
Yeah, 100%. Memorial weekend. It's a opening weekend for a lot of people to break their boat out. It's hot outside. People are out. Families are traveling to come see you. You have made plans with everyone to go out on the boat. And some things go right. Some things go wrong. We're coming up on another one of those July 4th. You guys have family members, friends, weeks. You've been telling them, months maybe. Hey, come on, we're going to go out on the boat. Have a great weekend. Make sure you are ready. It doesn't matter. You can take it to me. You can take it to someone else. This is just advice for you to have a successful time with your family and friends. If you work on your stuff yourself, check everything out. Make sure everything's right. You know, if you don't use your boat, you know, as often as these guys, John, Scott, everyone, you might have some things you need to work on and get right to be safe and have a, you know, productive weekend on the boat. If you don't work on it yourself, bring it in early. Let us get your boat, you know, in tip-top shape. Run it the weekend before. Know everything's right. So all that's left on your part is cleaning, if you wish. It depends how close you and your family are. Maybe you make them clean it before. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Be early, no matter what. If you're, you know, taking it to someone to help you out or doing it yourself, be as early as you can. Mm-hmm. This isn't, you know, such a just for things to go well. It's also a safety thing. You know, you're going to have, you know, a lot of people who you're close with on the water. Mm-hmm. And depending on where you live and where you launch from, things can get dangerous, you know. And with a big weekend like this, so many boats out, you want to make sure all your stuff is operating as it should.
What are some of the more common things that you see, like year after year, Memorial Day, July 4th, Labor Day weekend, like oversights, if you will, or things that people maybe don't think of otherwise? Like, what are some of the more common things that you're like, man, if they had just done this, they would have had a much better experience on the water?
Trailer lights, battery, fuel. I'd say in order of most common, battery. A lot of people, I mean, the thing could sit there for a week, even a couple of days, and your battery could die. Batteries, number one. They make trickle chargers. There's onboard ones. There's ones you can buy at West Marine, AutoZone, O'Reilly's, your parts store near you. Keep it on charge. If not, get a new battery. Keep that on charge. Second is fuel. If you have your ethanol filled fuel, if you don't buy non-ethanol fuel or don't have access to it,
yeah,
and that boat has been sitting there for longer than 2 weeks, it might be good for you not to even try to start it. That motor has, you know, contained sealed gas in it. It wasn't exposed to the elements of cold hot, like with room for condensation like your tank was. It might be best to bring it straight in or have it pumped out immediately before you start. That will save you a lot of headache and hassle. And the last thing is, there's so many people out going for the weekend. There's enough problems on the road as it is. Make sure your trailer lights work. That's for a safety thing and to keep you, you know, easy experience from your house to the dock to back.
What about when people have been told, I know you've dealt with this, well, the water in the tank? You know, that's something that I'm guessing you experience a lot with people that have their boats sitting. Give me that answer, plus the secret lives of coyotes on Hunting Season Never Ends, next right here on Sports Radio 610. Welcome back. Hope everyone is having a great Sunday. Chatting with JT Koshy from the Boatyard in Kima about making sure your boat is tip-top when you don't really get to use it a lot. Specifically, JT, we always hear about water in the tank.
It's really the ethanol that people are putting in fuel, or not people, we. You know, almost all gas stations, they contain, you'll see it right on the pump, contains 10, 15% ethanol. Ethanol attracts water. If kind of like if you leave a water bottle in your garage, as it's hot in the summer, you know, in the sun, and at night it gets colder, that temperature difference is enough to cause some condensation in that empty area of the water bottle.
Yeah.
That same thing's happening in your fuel tank. If it's got some space of empty, if it's not full up to the tip, you have some room for condensation. And once that happens, you know, a couple of weeks in a row without running it, you'll have enough water built up in there to for the motor to go, nope, I'm not running this. And that's really where the issue starts. So yeah, if you can avoid that, that'll save a lot of headache.
Good stuff, JT Koshy. You mentioned the trailer lights. I would also suggest and get your thoughts here real quick before we pop back to the podcast, the trailer hubs and the axles. What should you be looking for there?
Ask your local dealer who sold you the trailer how to maintenance it when you're buying. If you bought it used or maybe just off private market, Google how to maintenance your, you know, maintain your trailer. A lot of them have hubs where you can pop a cap off and get a grease gun, fill it up with, you know, marine grease or whatever grease you have, something to keep those bearings from getting too hot and causing issues. Check your tires. A lot of people, you know, oh, it's a trailer, it's a boat, it's light, no problem. Make sure your tires are filled up to the correct air capacity. Helps from blowouts. If you hit anything bad, having the right air in the tire supports the load and helps you not have a flat somewhere.
All right, JT, always appreciate your insight. So let's get back to it here. This has been incredibly hot. I mean, this week alone is 100 degrees every day. And of course, it gets me to thinking about, you know, what that might mean in terms of tropical storm and everything. I'm not a meteorologist, so I'm not going to speculate. But man, Scott, I don't know. Would you say you're off the water about when? Because I fished from 5:30 to probably too long, right before 11. But I'm a sicko. And then I went back out on the one day about 4:30. But this is unique, even from last year. Now I can't, you know, I know some we're always getting some hot summers, but this one seems especially bad.
Well, it's been real, real light winds this week for a change, which we've all been hoping for light winds, but then it ended up being 100 degrees on top of that. My bite, like I said, first thing in the morning, the reds are doing their thing, man. They're up shallow. There's toilet flushes going on in the marsh. You can hear it. They're blasting. They're up on top of the grass cruising. You know, we got some good shots at them. Then all of a sudden, about 9:30, they started disappearing. And we'd see a fish every now and one in particular. We saw a little bitty pothole, about basketball size pothole. Mm-hmm. And I could see the fish. He was backed into the grass and just his head sticking out in the pothole. My guys couldn't see it. And I eased him up and said, "Did you see that white pothole? You see that little dark spot off to the side? That's the head of a redfish." It was a good one. It was a 26, 27 inch fish.
Mm-hmm.
Just laying there. And I said, "I don't think he's going to eat, but put something in on him." And they started casting in there, and they literally hit this fish in the head, and it wouldn't move. It just sat there. And finally, it backed up into the grass and turned sideways and then snuggled down even deeper into the grass. And I looked at him and said, "We can keep fishing all y'all want, but they're done."
Yeah.
And from that point on, they wanted to keep at it for a while. They'd driven in from out of town.
Mm-hmm.
And we kept trying. We pushed it and pushed it and pushed it, and just wasn't anything going on. All the redfish, we started seeing them blow out, you know, from under the bow as we're pulling across shallow water, be big mud puff. And I can see redfish. I wasn't seeing these fish. We had about a foot of grass, and they were snuggled down so deep in that grass that you couldn't see them. And then you'd get nothing but a mud puff and then, you know, a wake as they were leaving. The only thing we did see about 10:30, 11 o'clock, I saw tails.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, "Oh my goodness. You know, look at this. There's actually tailing fish over here." And I pulled my butt off all the way across this big cove to get over to the tailing redfish, which turned out to be a whole wad of tailing hardheads.
Oh,
they tricked me three times. I got three schools of tailing hardheads.
God, I caught so many hardheads this week.
I mean, and these were schools of like 50 to 100 fish. And I mean, they were cutting up and it looked so good, you know, from a distance looking into the sun. And it's like, "Oh man, that's got to be tailing reds." You know, it's slick water and there's just this, all this rippling going on, little tails flicking up and splashes. Looks so good. We did catch one little trout out of it, about a 9-inch trout when mm-hmm. we went to them. But other than that, no, it was just hardheads.
Okay, let's get to hunting season never ends. Always great information here and always brought to us by Belleville Meat Market. Absolutely the best over there in every way, from what you can get there at the butcher shop to their unbelievable menu and, of course, the year-round processing, which is so, so good. Absolutely off the charts. Let's talk coyotes today. They really can be one of the most elusive, mysterious animals out there. Joined now by Captain Dean Thomas, who has a 1,000-acre ranch down in South Texas and had some recent experiences and insight. Not talking about his abrasive nature, not talking about fishing, not talking about Redfish Bay or Aransas Bay.
And what does that what does that leave? It's going to be quiet in here.
It doesn't leave a lot. Going to be kind of just staring at each other. Nah, man, we've had you on before here on Hunting Season Never Ends, talking about your ranch. We'll do it again because it's become a really popular segment here on the Bite Me Fishing Show. But you had something that you were working on this past weekend, and I said, you want to talk about that? Because that it seems really interesting. Coyotes are kind of – it's about coyotes, by the way, if you're just joining us. Coyotes are an interesting animal, a fascinating animal to me. Serve a purpose and yet still irritating, you know, can be, you know, somewhat, I guess, good in a sense for ranches, but also very, very bad. So,
well, I mean, they're a native member of the food chain. I mean, they have been here forever. It's not like an invasive species like feral hogs and things like that. So, but they are quite a nuisance to ranchers, to farmers, to hunters. And the crazy thing about coyotes is that there have been numerous attempts to eradicate them. I mean, from dropping poison from the sky, there has been all kinds of attempts, and they are the one species that has adapted, avoided those things, not only survive, they still thrive. Was reading some interesting facts, like whenever they're under stress, like they will actually produce twice as many litters a year as
really.
So they adjust to the population. They will repopulate faster when it needs to be, and they will not populate as fast whenever they are abundant. So, and they adapt to city life. There's urban coyotes. They live on the beach. They live in the deepest, darkest woods, brush. And a very, very smart creature.
Extremely smart.
Which brings me to trying to hunt them.
Yeah, and I want to get to that for sure, because we've all had our run-ins with coyotes, but my most memorable one was my dog Gibson, about really just probably less than a year before we had to put him down. So he was old, kind of wobbling around, and I would take him out. And this was when I was in Matagorda. I'd take him out, you know, to go to take care of his business. And I took him out one day, and I set him on the ground, and my property was fenced on both sides, but not in the back, because that's where the channel was. And as I set him down, I saw two coyotes turn the corner around the fence and just look at him and just look at me. And I freaked out, and I just immediately kind of ran to him and grabbed him. But as I ran to him, they took off. And so they're unafraid animals. I've also seen them, like you mentioned, on the beach, which is wild.
Yeah. And it's not an unafraid thing. They are aware. They're hyper aware of their surroundings. So if a threat exists, boom, they're gone. Then they will become afraid. But when they're in hunt mode, when they are in the pack, or when they're paired up and they're on the prowl, they will expose themselves. And if they're in that environment where they're kind of used to people and they've had interaction with people where they have not been shot at and not attacked, then they do get a little more comfortable. But they're always going to keep their distance. They're always going to keep their advantage. And that's the trick. Even if you saw that thing, they were in a position where they had the wind in their favor. They could hear what was going on. If they're showing themselves, they feel like they are in a dominant position. As soon as they feel threatened, that's going to be the most elusive creature you ever tried to find in your life.
Which leads to the whys and the hows of dealing with coyotes. Let's get into that next right here on Sports Radio 610. Welcome back. Talking coyotes here on Hunting Season Never Ends, brought to us every week by Belleville Meat Market. Dean, so your ranch, didn't you say it's like 900,000 acres, something like that?
It's about 1,000 acres.
1,000 acres. So
down south near Zapata, near Falcon Lake.
If you had to guess, or maybe you've had somebody, you know, estimate it, how many coyotes are roaming?
Oh, it would be impossible to pick that number. But so early in the morning before the sun comes up, you know, we're out there prowling around, especially during deer season. You're out there in the blind an hour before the sun comes up, and it is just pitch silence. I mean, you're sitting there silence, and you'll hear one coyote off in the corner somewhere start yapping. Mm-hmm. And then one on the other side will reply, and then another will reply. It's just they have a very good sense of communication. And when they will all start yapping, and it sounds like there's 100 out there. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to people about that, how they sound like there's so many. But people have told me that, you know, really tuned into the coyote world, that it's not as many as it sounds, that they make themselves sound like there's more of them that are actually there. Sounds like 100, probably closer to 20 or 30, but yeah. They will start the call, and it will go across the brush for 20 or 30 seconds until it is just deafening. Mm. And then like flipping a switch, it is silence again, and you will never hear another sound of them. But they do locate each other. They use a certain call to locate each other. Say, hey, man, I survived the night. I'm headed to the den. Meet me over there.
Kind of like us. Hey, you all right? Yeah, I'm good, man. I'll see you there.
We're going to go sleep all day now.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's an overpopulation, correct?
It can be, but coyotes still maintain a balance in nature. So javelinas are another one that are out there that are quite abundant, but it is a native natural species. Mm-hmm. So those species that have lived there and existed for eons, they do find a balance with nature. They live within that balance. That's why feral hogs that are invasive, they do not live within a balance. That is why it's just the easiest one to compare feral hogs to those kind of animals that do not have a balance in nature. They do not have a limit. They're just total destruction. They never quit reproducing at any level until they start eating each other.
Mm-hmm.
So coyotes do have a natural balance there that will keep nature will keep them in check.
Yeah. Who are their predators?
That would probably
mountain
lion. Big mountain lions.
It's hard to say.
Hogs would probably kill them and eat them if they found a weak one. Mm-hmm. You know, an old slow one or a crippled one that was wounded somehow somewhere. And not really sure the age span. Of a coyote either.
Because I was thinking, you know, obviously, you know, you wanted to get rid of some, and we're going to get right to that. But for the people who, I got to get rid of some coyotes, and they're in there blind, and they're trying to, or they see a coyote, where would you rank a coyote in terms of the difficulty of hunting?
Well, when we're out there deer hunting, or pig hunting, or quail hunting, whatever we're hunting, if you see a coyote, you coyote hunting. Those things.
It changes like that.
They move way up the list. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it is not uncommon during deer season when you're sitting in a blind to see two or three or four cross the sendera, step out in the field for a brief moment. But the thing about those guys, I mean, if you do not have a barrel out the window and are ready to go,
they're gone.
The window of shooting those things is going to be like 5 to 10 seconds. Mm-hmm. So it's really a matter of being on high alert and pointed in the right direction. In some of the wide open spaces, there is definitely a larger window of opportunity. Where we're hunting on our ranch, brush. It is very, very thick brush. So it is looking down the senderos, and those guys will poke their head out, or they'll walk into the road, stand there, look. 10 seconds is probably generous. It's closer to 5 seconds. I mean, you get a brief look at many of them cross the road and never stop moving.
Yeah.
So you don't even get a shot.
That's what I think most of us have ever seen. It's just like, well, oh, that was a coyote. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. That's about what you see.
All right. So I looked it up while we were talking. The lifespan of a coyote is up to 18 years.
But
that's crazy.
Average lifespan is 3 to 6.
Okay. Okay.
And they can live up. Well, I got 11 to 13 on this one.
Okay. But either way, they can get into the double.
Oh, in captivity, they can live to 14 to 20 as captivity.
Dang.
So that's fed on Alpo and stuff like that.
All right. So let's get into one of the things that I thought was most fascinating when we were talking. You wanted to get, let's get some coyotes. You wanted to target them. And you had a very particular way. Take us through that.
Well, I have attempted hunting them for the past year and a half, maybe 2 years. So I got the Fox Pro, the collar. It's got numerous calls on it. It's got a little decoy that mounts on top of it. It's a little furry ball. It wiggles in the grass and shakes. And so you can put a squealing rabbit. You can put a coyote in heat. There's 100 calls on this thing to attract them, to draw them out of the brush. And so I've been trying. I've been going out there, sitting in the brush, zero success. Have a really good friend, Josh Parrish, who I would be on the phone with him, texting him. I'm like, I feel like an idiot. I'm sitting out here. I'm like, what am I doing wrong? Why is this not working? And he was coaching me through the whole deal, you know, about check your wind. If they see you, hear you, or smell you, you will not see them. They are, they become aware. So, and I did, I mean, I put a lot of effort into this. Now, there's really a follow-up to that part at the end of the story. So I was attempting it, and I was feeling like I was unsuccessful because I was not seeing them. Mm-hmm. So I invited Josh to the ranch. Josh is a professional predator hunter. They hunt competitions. They go to these contests where they sit out there for several nights in a row where they're hunting bobcats and coyotes in these competitions, and they have thermal vision for night hunting. A lot of experience with different calls and what is effective at different times of year. Right now, especially in the spring, there's a lot of pups. They're all it's breeding season, and so there's a lot of young, really new. I mean, he kept calling them dumb, but I was like, man, things don't look too dumb because they were so I wanted him to come to the ranch and just to help me build some confidence. At least I knew I was doing it right. So yes, we went out, we did some night hunting, and it absolutely worked. We were calling coyotes in, but those coyotes that we were seeing were hanging on the perimeter. They were still ultra cautious. And I took a couple shots, missed, but hunting with the thermal sight, it was the first time I had done that also. Hunting at night with the night vision and the thermal is not like hunting in the daytime with the rectangle of a scope that is daylight. One of the things that really messed me up is, so you're out there in the pitch black dark, and when you're looking, when you're scanning through the thermal is lit up. So one of your eyes is gathering light. Your pupil is dilated. The other eyeball is in night vision. It is in the pitch black dark. Yeah. So when you look away, you have one eye that is dilated, one that is not. And so it was really messing with my vision. And then there's a lot of variety. Thermal optics are very, very expensive. And when it comes to those, that type of gear, the most expensive gear is the highest clarity. It is the It's like a video camera. So it
is, is it heat sensitive? Like the body
absolutely.
Of the
plane? That yeah. It and so what you can see, I mean, you can see trees that are warm, that like the tree trunks that mm-hmm. still have heat from the daytime, mm-hmm. rocks that the sun was shining on are lit up. It is a thermal heat picture of what you're looking at. That is exactly what it is detecting.
Is the picture animals, clear when you see a coyote?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But so you can have, it's just like a camera where you go from 1080
yeah.
to 4K to 5K and yeah. the clarity. So, you know, the stuff that we were hunting with wasn't the 5K and the 6K. Yeah. It is still great. It is still amazing, but you have to get tuned into it. Your eyes have to get trained for it. You have to focus on the sights
mm-hmm.
where the crosshairs are. And it was just a very much a learning experience. And the first time, and that's what Josh told me, he's like, dude, so the first time of this, he says, you're going to be surprised. He says, it's not what you think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And he was 100% right. But the I considered the whole thing a huge success from mm-hmm. what I learned. And then, so here's another thing. So I've been sitting out there with my little box and my little wiggle tail out there in the brush,
mm-hmm.
thinking that I was not calling coyotes. Mm-hmm. We were definitely calling them. We just weren't seeing them.
Mm.
That, I guarantee you they were in that brush. They were on the perimeter because the places that we went out there in the dark with the thermal vision, they were out there. They're mm-hmm. on the perimeter. They're just so sneaky, so suspicious that you got to really catch them slipping up to get a shot.
Great stuff. But let's get the rest of that story. We need to know and what our listeners can get from your experience. That's next right here on the Bite Me Fishing Show on Sports Radio 610. Welcome back. Happy Sunday. So last segment, we were talking about your experience trying to get the coyote. And so did you have the little decoy thing out while you had the thermal?
No, well, in the nighttime, no. In the night, that mm-hmm. doesn't apply because they're not going to see. And actually, we put the call like right under our feet. I mean, we're standing on the call on the box
mm-hmm.
and just constantly circling the perimeter, just scanning, constantly scanning in every direction. And you see their little heads pop up back there in the brush. You see their neck stretch out. They'll sniff around for a minute. Boom, run to the next spot. And then they're hiding behind trees. They're hiding in the brush. I mean, they just don't stand out there and go broadside. And I thought deer hunting was hard.
That's what I'm asking, yeah.
Deer hunting is easy compared to coyote hunting. You get a deer to walk out, you know, and just kind of stand there and look around for a while, mm-hmm. Turn broadside and kind of pose for a shot.
So they're not even stupid when they're in heat, like the rut.
No, they do not have a weak moment.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, my question was after watching them come to this call and stuff, I was asking Josh, I was like, can we bait these things with Alpo? I mean, can we bring some dog food out here, you know, and put it in a pile like you're corning for a deer? And he said you actually can bait, but he says it's not going to be dog food. It's raw meat, like mm-hmm. hamburger meat is mm-hmm. what they're going to smell and come to. And then during the season, you know, during deer season, whenever we're cleaning deer, we have the boneyard area where we're constantly dumping carcasses and gut piles. And I've put my game camera on the gut piles and taken pictures of all the buzzards and all the caracaras that just come and destroy three deer carcasses in like 3 hours. They clean every single scrap up. And in that melee, the coyotes also come to those gut piles.
Well, that's where you need to put your thermal box.
And it's all leading up to a grand conclusion where one of these days,
yeah.
But even to put the blind or a new stand where I can see the boneyard, where mm-hmm. I can see the gut pile and then shoot them.
Yeah.
When they're coming into that. But coyotes kill deer. They kill fawns.
Yeah, that's the last thing I wanted to ask you about. Like why, you know, we talked about, you know, their purpose and their cohabitation in our natural environment, but they're bad. I mean, what kind of, Well, what kind of trouble are they causing you?
Well, the ranch is a playground for deer and quail and turkeys and those things that we enjoy. Mm-hmm. And look, man, I mean, I don't go out and kill animals. Well, I will kill pigs, feral hogs, just for the sake of killing. It's like stomping on a cockroach. I mean, those things are horrible. But when it comes to raising and managing a deer herd, and these deer down there on the ranch are beautiful. It's amazing. This ranch has been managed for deer for 20 years. There's no cattle on it. It has feed. It has water. It has cover. It has everything to raise world-class South Texas bucks, as good as they get. And these coyotes eat fawns. I mean, it is one of their number one food sources whenever the does are having babies. So letting those coyotes run unchecked, and quail. I mean, they eat quail, they eat deer. So it's just a matter of limiting them or harassing them enough where they go live on the neighbor's ranch.
So what about deterrence to that point? I know like a lot of farms that have cattle, and they eat those calves as well. They put donkeys out there, and you know, to deter them. But is that not even that's not a possibility or what?
No, I mean, that's the donkeys that are protecting the cattle are living with the herd. Mm-hmm. I mean, then a donkey's not, and these deer aren't in a herd either. You know, they've spread out along the ranch. So that type of thing is not going to work, but just harassing them, keeping the pressure on them, limiting their numbers, forcing them to go to the next ranch, forcing them to, you know, feel the heat a little bit and not be as comfortable. I don't want them living free and easy, man. I want them
I have a rough life.
I want that coyote looking over his shoulder every time he sticks his neck out.
Yeah.
But yes, they do. They kill deer, and you know, every one of those deer takes a lot of effort to create one of those fawns and to be feeding coyotes. It's just it's not what we're after there.
And those fawns end up being fantastic deer sometimes.
Oh, I mean, that's they grow into amazing animals. So, but it's part of the process, but it's just part of protecting what we want to thrive there and harassing the others that that we don't. But great experience, learned a lot.
You'll get them.
Exactly. So the next time I'm out there, I'll have confidence in what I'm doing. Cause I was completely, lost my confidence. I was even, when I would text Josh, I was like, just for once, I want to see this work. And that is, he came down there and, but man, I still don't know if I mean, $3,000 to $4,000 for thermal optics.
Yeah. That's a lot.
It's an expensive toy. I mean, and I say it all the time, man, I like cool things, but I'm still on a budget. I'm on a cool thing budget. But yeah, that is an expensive toy for something that but it can also work for shooting pigs at night for I'm slowly talking myself into it.
I think you have. I think you're just waiting for the right time to spring it.
Around Christmas time, they have great sales.
Yeah.
I'm going to shop the bargain rack when it happens.
All right, we'll let you go. But how are things at the ranch right now this time of year, you know, going into middle June, late June?
Man, down south, it's been 108 degrees already on certain days. The good thing about this year is that we've had the most rain this spring than we've had for the past 5 years. The desert rebounds quickly.
It's green?
Oh my God. It's waist high grass.
That's
green.
Awesome.
Everything is blooming, but that's how the desert lives. I mean, it goes dormant until it gets rained, and then it takes complete advantage of the rain that it gets. It bursts with life.
And you got water.
And the ponds are full.
Yeah.
It is beautiful. It is amazing to see it so green. And I mean, in the field, the sides of the road, the yard around the house is waist high, beautiful green grass.
Awesome. Awesome. All right, brother. I'll see you soon and appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
Fantastic. Appreciate the fellas doing that thing they do so well here today and every day on the Bite Me Fishing Show. Make sure you book the captains, Captain Scott, Captain Dean, and or Captain Caleb. It'll be a very memorable fishing trip. I can promise you that. And thanks to JT Koshy. Most of all, thanks to you, as always. We'll do it again Thursday at 4 a.m. right here on Sports Radio 610. Until then, have a great rest of your Sunday. Be safe, catch them up, and we'll talk to you next time.